So what I wanted to discuss this morning about the beginning of this encounter at Keshi. Keshi is the old name, also known as Varanasi, now known as Benares, which has always been a Mayavadi headquarters. It's their one of their strongholds. And for some reason or another, two of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's disciples or followers were there, Tapan Mishra and Chandrasekhar. So, he visited them. Now, the beginning part of this chapter, which you may not have read recently, this chapter is called the Panchatattva. Yeah, Lord Chaitanya in Five Features, I think, is the name of this chapter, actually. It's not given here in this book, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, Lord Chaitanya in Five Features. It first came out as a little booklet all by itself. Your name is Krishnaksha. Please try to be on time, okay? And this is your Bhakti John. So, it begins with this wonderful description of how the Panchatattva were plundering the storehouse of love of God. It says, the storehouse descended with Krishna, but it remained locked. And then the Panchatattva broke open that lock and plundered the storehouse and distributed the contents to everybody. And in this way, by their chanting and dancing, they inundated the whole world with the flood of love of Godhead. It's a very interesting statement, by the way, that the storehouse descended with Krishna, but it remained locked until Lord Chaitanya appeared. So then it describes that they were seeing that everybody was getting caught up in this flood of love of Godhead, but certain people were escaping. And those escapees are listed in here. Thank you. Impersonalists, fruitive workers, false logicians, blasphemers, non-devotees, and lowest among the student community were very expert in avoiding the Krishna consciousness movement. So, that's number 20. Excuse me, that's page 22. It's verse 29 and 30. So at any rate, finally, he decides that he has to really try to capture the Mayavadis. They were fleeing. And so he devised a trick, especially designed to trap the Mayavadis. And that was to become a Mayavadi sannyasi. That's what he did. Lord Chaitanya was a Mayavadi sannyasi. He didn't wear a tilak. He didn't have a shika. He had an ekadanda. He was a Mayavadi sannyasi. And that was his trick. So then, and you'll see it pays off, because when he goes to Varanasi, to Keshi, they say, hey, you're one of us. What are you doing with these low-class people, you know? He's accepted as one of them. So this describes how he dealt with the Mayavadis. So once he was, says here, beginning in text 40, that he was passing through on his way to Vrindavan, and they began to criticize him. They leveled charges against him. Oh, by the way, there's always been, already been several, in the earlier part of the chapter, the Mayavadi has been defined. I'll give you the page numbers. There's definitions of Mayavadi on page 25. Huh? Not everyone has the same text. Okay. I wanted to mention this. In the purport to text 33, Mayavadi is defined. You should make note of this definition, because this is the kind of thing that shows up on exams and other things. And then in the purport to text 39, Mayavadi is also defined. And later on, it'll be defined again. Further on in this chapter, in the purport to text number 100. Okay? just in passing, that's where Mayavada is defined. It mentions here in text 33 that there's these Kashi, there's two kinds of Mayavadis are mentioned here. The ones from Benares, who are called the Kashira Mayavadis from Benares. Those are the followers of Shankaracharya. They're called Shira Mayavadis. And near Varanasi at Saranath are Buddhists. They're called Saranath Mayavadis. So we're dealing with the Kashira Mayavadis here.
39.
And there he gives a definition at the end of that of Mayavadis. Both kind of Mayavadi and personalist conclude that the subject matter of bhakti yoga is a creation of Maya, and that Krishna, devotional service, and the devotee are also Maya. Therefore, as stated by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Mayavadi Krishna Aparadi. All the Mayavadis are offenders to Lord Krishna. It is not possible for them to understand the Krishna consciousness movement. Therefore, we do not value their philosophical conclusions. However, experts such quarrelsome and personalists are in putting forward their so-called logic, we defeat them in every respect and go on with our Krishna consciousness movement. So this is a statement that we have to be able to defeat them. So anyway, they criticized Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He passed through once and they criticized him. And the criticisms of Lord Chaitanya are in text 40 and 41. And then when he meets with them, they repeat the same criticisms, text 66 to 70. And that's the first thing I want to do, is show you, go over these criticisms with you, because we get them too. This is what they say about him. Well, they start out by saying he's a sannyasi. He's not following the rules of his order. He does not take an interest in Vedanta, but chants and dance in Sankirtan. Then they say he's an illiterate sannyasi and does not know his real function. Guided only by his sentiments, bhavuka, he's a sentimentalist. He wanders about in the company of other sentimentalists. Right? That's their thing. He's illiterate. Not very well, can't be very well educated. He's engaged in sentiment. So then later on, verse 66, he shows up when he comes to the Brahmin's house where all the sannyasis are meeting. Prakasananda Saraswati addresses him. He wants to know, first of all, you belong to our sampradaya, you're Shankaracharya follower. And you're living in our town. Why do you avoid us? Just like we say to someone, why don't you ever come to the temple? You know. Why are you avoiding our association? And then he says, you are a sannyasi. Why then do you indulge in chanting and dancing, engaging in your Sankirtan movement in the company of fanatics? Same word, bhavuka. Bhavuka. So sentimentalists or fanatics. He says, meditation and the study of the Vedanta are the sole duties of a sannyasi. Why do you abandon these to dance with fanatics?
What's that word?
Bhavuka. You're not following the text. Bhava is, you know, sentiment. Bhavuka. It's a Bengali word. You look as brilliant as if you were Narayan himself. Will you kindly explain the reason you have adopted the behavior of low-class people? The behavior of low-class people. So there it is. The difficulty we face in Krishna consciousness is that enthusiasm is low class. The upper classes, they sit very, they sit in their pews. Their services are very staid. They don't show very much emotion, right? All over the world, the system is there. But then when you get down among the low class people, then they're jumping up and down and hollering and screaming and banging on tambourines and so on, right? So there's a distinction, for example, commonly made if you study religions in colleges, about two kinds of religion, reflective and popular. Reflective religion is of intellectuals and thinkers, and then popular is enthusiastic, excited, full of energy, but not so bright. So when people see devotees on Sankirtan, immediately the instant stereotype is Hinachar, low class, behavior of low class people. You know, bangers, you know, because before we came, there used to be the Salvation Army out there with tambourines and so on. So this is always, this is the stereotype. A few years ago, I was asked to give a paper before some professors, scholars at the American Academy of Religion. And so I decided to give this paper about the scholarly tradition in Lord Chaitanya's movement. So I know this is the first thing, because I see Krishna consciousness, you know, or Vaishnavism is always presented as, again, same way, popular religion, enthusiasm. Enthusiasm, by the way, used to be, in the last century in England, I don't know if it still is, a term of putting people down. Enthusiasm. It was, the Church of England was not had enthusiasm, but it was the Methodists and people like that in chapels that was called enthusiasm. It was very definitely a term of opprobrium. So when I delivered this paper, this has been reprinted in the as an appendix to that book by Satyaraj on Lord Chaitanya. So I begin by telling them, I say, one of the signs of health in a religious tradition is its ability to integrate emotion and intellect, so that all thought is energized by feeling and feeling is disciplined and directed by thought. Because that's the distinction they've made, you see, reflective religion and popular religion. So I say, no, actually they should be integrated, which they'll all admit, actually. Then I say, Prabhupada recognized this, and in his commentary to the Bhagavad Gita, he remarked that devotion and reflection are interdependent, this is quoting, are interdependent as religion and philosophy. Religion without philosophy is sentiment, or sometimes fanaticism, while philosophy without religion is mental speculation. So this is what these sannyasis, you have no philosophy. You can't be. This has to be all sentiment, low-class stuff like that. Of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is going to show them, but which tells us what we have to be able to do too. Anyway, I go on to say, the ideal of integrating feeling and thinking in religion is not always or even often realized. More often than not, we encounter religious traditions in which the two, feeling and thinking, have been separated. They become two-tiered religions, so to speak. The lower tier is made up of a fervently emotional, relentlessly enthusiastic, and obstinately convinced following, which understands its traditions, scriptures, and symbols, I put in quotation mark, literally, and feels threatened by reason and even education. The upper tier is made up of an urbane intelligentsia, often clergy, which is embarrassed by the naively faithful, and which has worked out a sophisticated piece of intellectual machinery, enabling them to indulge in the same language and rituals as the naively faithful, while intending something quite different by it, allegiance to a rational ethic or metaphysics, which is what their religion really amounts to, mythically conveyed. So in other words, when you get these two, the intellectuals are busy saying, yes, we can talk about God or we can talk about Jesus, but then if you look at the philosophy they have, they find a way of not really having to believe it. They write books with things like, you know, the ethical meaning of the Gospels or... Anyway, I give examples, which we'll see in this class. I think that this sort of two-tiered religion is religion in a disintegrated form, even though theologies have been composed to justify it. For example, those of Shankaracharya in the East and Paul Tillich in the West. We'll be encountering a little bit of Tillich. Anyways, when I read this in front of this group, there was like a lot of laughter. You know, they knew exactly what I was talking about. They're quite aware of the phenomena. So this is something that we're up against when people encounter the Krishna consciousness movement. Immediately, they think that we cannot be thinkers, that we cannot be intelligent, that we cannot be reflective. And they think if we really believe the stories about Krishna, that we would have to be stupid. You know, you have to be, you know, like a born-again fundamentalist Christian who is very threatened by education or reflection and so on. So this is the same kind of charge is brought against Lord Chaitanya is going to be, is that's what people think of us too. So in this way, we're in the same situation. They of course, they're wondering because they see him as a deserter. After all, he's born in a Brahmin family. He was educated at, you know, the Oxford and Cambridge of India at the time. And now what he's done, he's become a dropout. And he's gone slumming with these bhavakas, these low-class, sentimental people, you know. So it's just like, you know, suddenly seeing the Archbishop of Canterbury on the street corner with Jehovah's Witnesses or somebody, you know. Like they say, what's happened? That's their reaction to him. So that's the context. And this idea, anyway, that anytime there's feeling and emotion, public displays of those things, it's not very high class thing to do. So we have to redefine that for people. So now we want to look at the methods that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu uses to deal with them. And this is very, very instructive because many of them we can follow. For example, his first method, we don't really necessarily have to follow, even directly or indirectly, but he became a Mayavadi sannyas. We don't have to become a Mayavadi sannyas in order to preach to the Mayavadis. They're not sannyasis anymore either. So you don't run into too much of that. Then the second thing he did, if you go through this, he accepted the invitation. When he came back, let me just backtrack a little bit. So these criticisms were voiced when he went through once. When he came back, Tapan Mishra and Chandrasekhar were very upset about these criticisms of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. They couldn't counteract him, which Prabhupada says, which means they're Kanishta Adhikaris, although they were pure devotees. They couldn't counteract him. And they begged Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to do something. So then a Brahmin came through and invited him to his house. He's invited all the sannyasis of Benares to his house. And would Chaitanya Mahaprabhu please come? So he broke his rule about associating with these people. And he went to the house of this Brahman, where the sannyasis and their leader, Prakashananda Saraswati, were meeting. So he sat in the vestibule where everybody washes his feet and didn't come in and join all the other sannyasis, right? And the first thing he does is what? Who remembers? What did he do? Yes? Graham? Yeah, he exhibited his Aishvarya Prakash. Was that what it called? Aishvarya Prakash, yeah, his mystic opulence. And they all saw his effulgence, right? Well, that's another thing we need not bother to try to imitate. And in fact, Prabhupada in his purport goes on at quite some length about how this is not the thing to try to do. He offered his obeisances. He's very respectful. And so they gazed up, and they says they stood in respect. These people are all interested in going to the Brahmajyoti, so when they see it, you know, they stood in respect. And then so Prakashananda Saraswati comes and brings him in, invites him in. And the Lord says, why are you sitting there? Are you lamenting something? He says, I belong to a lower order of sannyas. The Hebrews are Bharati. In fact, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu kept his brahmachari name. Chaitanya is a brahmachari name. He didn't change his name to a sannyas name, but he was a Bharati of the different orders in the Mayavadi ranks. So he says, and they were not... that high level on the Mayavadi social scale. In fact, when he meets later with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya finds out that he was a Bharati, he wanted to teach him so he could bring him up, because you know he was a relative, and you know he knew his father and everything, and he thought it was too bad that he was, you know, just a Bharati, and he could bring him up to be a, you know, a Saraswati or something, you know, raise him up a little bit. So he says, I belong to a lower order of sannyas. Therefore, I do not deserve to sit with you. So notice his humility. Now, this is the next point that was very attractive about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, aside from his Aishvarya Prakash, was his extreme humility. And if we look at text 52 in the purport, Prabhupada makes a very important point that we have to see when we want to know how to deal with Mayavad philosophers and how to defeat them. Mayavadis of different kinds. No, is that right? What did I say, text 52? That's not right. No, that's the wrong text. Maybe I meant page 52. Just a second. Yes, I'm sorry. It's purport to text 68. Prabhupada says that to be a candidate for Vedanta philosophy, the qualification is Trinadapi sunichena tororapi suhishnena, so on. Amanina maninandena kirtaniya sadahari. This statement indicates that one can hear or speak about Vedanta philosophy through the disciplic succession. One must be very humble and meek, more tolerant than a tree, and more humble than the grass. One should not claim respect for himself, but should be prepared to give all respects to others. One must have these qualifications to be eligible to understand Vedic knowledge. That's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was teaching. And this is the qualification that was exhibited to these sannyasis there, and also they found this very, very attractive. And what was the result of that is the fourth item, is he caused Prakasananda Saraswati, if you look at text 65, Prakashananda Saraswati, however, caught Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu personally by the hand and seated him with great respect in the midst of the assembly. And Prabhupada explains in the purport that this behavior is agata sukriti. And therefore, pious activity that one executes without his knowledge. Thus, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, very tactfully, when Prabhupada says tactfully, he means by using tactics. Doesn't exactly mean what most commonly think of tactful, which means being very polite and considerate, but he means by using clever means. Very tactfully gave Prakashananda Saraswati an opportunity to advance in Agyanta Sukriti so that in the future he might actually become a Vaishnava sannyasi. So that's one thing he did there. He caused him to perform imperceptible devotional service. That's very important. That's something we can do. So then they make their charges against him, and then there's a long discussion by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which is summarized on page 77 if you have this book, which is in the purports to text 95 and 96. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu presented himself in this way. I am a great fool and do not have knowledge of right and wrong. In order to understand the real meaning of Vedanta Sutra, I never followed the explanations of the Shankara Sampradaya or Mayavadi sannyasis. In other words, he's really saying, I couldn't understand it because it didn't make any sense. That's what he means to say. I'm very much afraid of the illogical arguments of the Mayavadi philosophers. I think I have no authority regarding their explanations of Vedanta Sutra. I firmly believe that simply chanting the holy name of the Lord can remove all misconceptions of the material world, and so on. Anyway, from there to the end of the purport, a summary of that whole discussion, if you want to see that. 95 through 96. Prabhupada summarizes his whole discussion. Now, when he tells this, in text 99, Mishtavakya, sweet words. This speech by Lord Chaitanya is described as sweet words. After hearing Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, all the Mayavadi sannyasis were moved. Their minds changed. And they spoke to him in very pleasing words too. So it says, doesn't show up in the translation, but after hearing the sweet words of Mahaprabhu, Mishtavakya, their minds were changed. So he spoke to them very, very, very nicely. So, from here, we can see certain things. And actually, on page 80, which is the purport to text 99, Prabhupada tells us how we have to deal when we're going to preach to Mayavadis, which we've seen here. He says, the original purpose of the Mayavadi sannyasis of Benares in meeting Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was to defeat his personal conception of God. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, however, as a preacher, turned the minds of the Mayavadi sannyasis. They were melted by the sweet words of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and thus they became friendly and spoke to him also in sweet words. Similarly, all preachers will have to meet opponents, but they should not make them more inimical. They are already enemies. And if we talk with them harshly or impolitely, their enmity will merely increase. We should therefore follow in the footsteps of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as far as possible, and try to convince the opposition by quoting from the Shastras and presenting the conclusion of the Acharyas It is in this way we should try to defeat the enemies of the Lord. So first of all, be nice. Be sweet. Attract them. And then deal with their philosophy. So these are the two stages that have to go through. I like this. So by being humble, that we can try. We have no mystic powers, and we don't need to become Mayavadis. But the humility of a devotee is very attractive naturally. So if in dealing with people, one exhibits especially a service attitude, and then how in our situation can we get them to get a Gyata Sukriti? Anybody have any suggestions?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. What else?
They can give a donation.
Yeah, they can give a donation. Yeah. Prasadam is one big... All Mayavadis love prasadam. That's one simple one that without doing anything else, if you give them prasadam, they make spiritual advancement. What else? You want to say that? Yeah?
To get them to take a book.
Magazine, the same thing, give some money. Also chant, yeah. Also chant. This has been, this is a good strategy. Is they don't have to go through any mental changes. They can come in with any conception they want, but they can chant Hare Krishna. Because Prabhupada says you don't have to change your philosophy in order to chant. They can chant, and they like chanting too.
Some
chant already. But if they chant with us, it'll be better. They like to chant and they love prasad, you know. So the first step, at least, is to give prasad and to get them involved with chanting. That's Agyata Sukriti for them. And behave in a very nice way. You know? This is something that I've seen. Our original approach was always sort of blast them, you know, at least when I was a new devotee. Of course, then people were very antagonistic. I mean, you used to really meet Mayavadis, you know, in a horrible way sometimes. They used to walk. I remember one guy walked into the temple, you know, on a Sunday feast and took me aside afterwards and he says, "I'm very pleased with the way you're worshiping me here." It's a true story. You know, so you kept meeting people like that. The tendency was really to jump down their throats, you know. But this is very important. He said, Prabhupada says, they're already inimical. See, because the thing is if they're attracted to Krishna consciousness, then if you destroy their misgivings, their intellectual misgivings, then they can become devotees. If you see we're actually ladies and gentlemen, then they won't think, oh, well, these are low-class people, I can't be part of it. If they see we can actually think, then they think, well, this is intellectually respectable. You know, I can do that. So if they're attracted to begin with, then you simply have to clear the way for them to do what they really want to do, which is become devotees. If they're actually demons, well, that's another thing. We don't have to worry about them, do we? We just avoid them. They'll go away. Yes?
Srila Bhaktisiddhanta is famous for his Shunya Guru, when he would smash
him. Yeah. Yeah.
What would be the outcome of that transaction? They get purified, obviously.
Yeah, they would get purified. My impression is that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was doing something else. Now, there are many institutions in India, and people are not about to change their minds. So if you smash them, I mean, smashing them does have their place, because the people you're dealing with won't change their minds, but sometimes the audience will. Sometimes the audience will. But this is especially appealing now because I tell you, most of the Mayavadis we deal with these days are New Age people, at least in the West. They're all New Age people. And it is, you know, the ground rule that you can't criticize anybody. And as soon as you become critical, judgmental, confrontational, you know, you're out right off the bat. And you really have to be aware of that. That's just the atmosphere right now. Of course, they're so open because, you know, so they can let any amount of nonsense go on. I mean, it's there for a purpose. But one has to be very, very careful, because very easy to alienate people right off the bat. So we should try not to make... This is Prabhupada's general rule. And then according to time and place and circumstances, sometimes, you know, you have to smash them.
There was one example of Prabhupada's governors. One of them was a meeting, and his Maivadi stood up, and one of Prabhupada's governors smashed the guy. And other governors were attending the meeting, came back and complained to
Well, it's just the Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati was doing one thing, which was really coming out from below and reestablishing the tradition of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when so many other nonsense things were going away, going around in the name of that. But if we can convince people, first of all, this way, to persuade them, that's the best thing. And then if we have to, then there can be some kind of confrontation. It depends on the circumstances. Anyway, these are Prabhupada's general instructions here. And they're in this chapter, so I always take them as the preferential thing to do. Try that first. If that doesn't work, then next thing. Yeah.
One is in the second class, in the devotion, so isn't he not supposed to argue with the envious?
No, he's supposed to preach to the innocent and avoid the demons. But many, many innocent people are acting like demons because they don't know any better. So after they hear from you, Krishna conscious, then you can separate out, you know, who's actually innocent and who's really a demon.
Yeah. So the point of alienating people, sometimes you find that you'll be deliberately asked a question, so the person who's asked the question can determine which camp you're in. Or say, you know, what do you think about such and such a type of philosophy? And so they're almost putting you in a position of having to say, okay, we're this and they're that, and distinguishing between the two.
Well, you know, well, the way Prabhupada do, they'd say to him, what do you think of so-and-so? And Prabhupada would say, well, what is his philosophy? That way you don't attack anybody personally. But then somebody says, well, they think that. And then you say, well, this is... Or you say, well, that's all right. Or else you say, well, it's wrong. And you just deal with the philosophy. But if somebody asked me, you know, what do you think of, you know, what do you think of... Mayor Baba, I would say, I don't know much about Mayor Baba. What is his philosophy? And they say, well, the only truth is silence. Well, how does he preach that? You know. Or whatever, you know. Then you just deal with the philosophy. Let's go on here. I want to make a few more points. Anyway, these are Prabhupada's instructions. So best thing is to attract people and then clean away the impediments to their becoming devotees. He was there to make them into devotees. If you're dealing with people that you'll never make into devotees, then you can take another tactic in smashing them. But if you want to make them into devotees, you should first attract them. Now, another point that's made here in this chapter is that the devotee should be conversant with Vedanta philosophy. Because the other thing is we have to be able to deal with these people philosophically. We can't just be sentimentalists. Prabhupada never wanted, that's why he published so many books. So he wouldn't be a sentimentalist. That's why the six Goswamis went through all the scriptures and established in the soundest possible way the philosophy of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That's why we're not just, you know, the lower tier of a two-tiered religion. This is actually the integrated religion. So if you look at text 102 in the purport, Prabhupada says, Vaishnavas do not neglect Vedanta. Sometimes the word Vedanta is used as a synonym for Mayavadi philosophy, but that's not true. Vaishnavas do not neglect Vedanta. But they do not care to understand Vedanta on the basis of the Shariraka Bhashya commentary. Remember that Shariraka Bhashya, that's the name of Bhashya means commentary. Commentary. And Shariraka. Shariraka means one who is embodied. That's the name of Shankaracharya's commentary. An embodied soul. Sharira, one who has a body. Sharira is body. Sharira avijja, you know, body. Shariraka Bhashya. Commentary. So then Lord Chaitanya, because here you see Lord Chaitanya says, okay, because they say to him, well, why don't you speak something on Vedanta? He says, okay, if you want, I can do that. So Prabhupada says, yes, we have to do this too. And he talks about Jiva Goswami, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. One must know very well that Vaishnava philosophers are not sentimentalists or cheap devotees like the Sahajiyas. All the Vaishnava Acharyas were vastly learned scholars who understood Vedanta philosophy fully, for unless one knows Vedanta philosophy, he cannot be an Acharya. So, also, if we look back a little bit, he makes the same point earlier on page 56 in this edition, which is the purport to text number 72. Talks about how the Sahajiyas don't care to touch the Vedanta Sutras. A real Vaishnava should, however, study Vedanta philosophy. One should not be a Mayavad, but one should not be unaware of the subject matter of Vedanta philosophy. Indeed, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu exhibited his knowledge of Vedanta in his discourses with Prakashananda Saraswati. Thus it is to be understood that a Vaishnava should be completely conversant with Vedanta philosophy. But of course he should not think it's everything. And he shouldn't become an impersonalist. Right? So this is another instruction from Srila Prabhupada. Now, he says, okay, he says, if you want, I can say something to you regarding Vedanta philosophy. And then he begins to talk about the Vedanta Sutras, which we'll discuss tomorrow, Vedanta Sutras and what they are and everything like that. But this, in this sense, his context is quite different from our context as preachers. He's dealing with another group of people, that is to say, the followers of Shankaracharya, and both Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the followers of Shankaracharya accept the authority of the Vedas and of the Vedanta Sutra. And our situation is quite different. We deal with people who don't accept that authority. So a large part of this conversation that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is about what is the real meaning of the Vedanta Sutras. For most people we'll deal with, they don't care what the real meaning of the Vedanta Sutras is. Now I want to read to you from an introduction to a book on Advaita Vedanta. By the way, if you want a little book that has a lot of summary of the Advaita Vedanta philosophy, this guy is named Elliot Deutsch. That's a C. Elliot. Yeah. His book is called Advaita Vedanta, A Philosophical Reconstruction. Published in Honolulu, 1969. A short, slim book. So he explains in the beginning of this introduction, this is a priceless passage here. You've got to listen to this one. He says, one of the major difficulties that we in the West, that's going to be the use of the, notice the use of the word we in there, that we in the West have with Indian thought in general, and with Vedanta in particular, nevertheless, is to be found in what may be called its traditional grounding. A Vedantic system bases itself upon ancient texts. And one of its primary tasks is to show that these texts represent a consistent and singular point of view. Systematic Vedanta was thus formulated in terms of scriptural exegesis. You know this word? Exegesis means giving the purports to the scriptures. Exegesis. That's a word for it, explaining the meaning of scriptural text called exegesis. Systematic Vedanta was thus formulated in terms of scriptural exegesis as much as it was formulated in terms of philosophical analysis. The exegetical dimension of Vedanta is of great interest to students of linguistics and Indian cultural history, and naturally to Indian scholars themselves, but it is of very little interest to Western students of philosophy. We do not accept the authority of the Veda, or, for the most part, the authority of any other scripture. Consequently, we are not concerned whether one system or another best interprets certain obscure passages in it. Our criterion of philosophical truth or significance is not whether a particular system of thought is consistent with some other body of work. Rather, it is whether that system of thought is consistent, he puts it in quotation marks, with human experience. Philosophically, we judge a system of thought in terms of its adequacy in organizing the various dimensions of our experience, in terms of its providing us with new ways of looking at, gaining insight into, the nature of the world and our life in it, and in terms of the kinds of arguments used to sustain these insights. Furthermore, most of us who are acquainted with the ancient Indian religious philosophical texts are quite convinced that they do not express a single consistent viewpoint, but that they express a very rich diversity of experience and reflection upon it. So, this is the modern point of view. We do not accept authority of the Veda, or for that matter, any other scripture. So here in Benares, they all accept the authority of the Veda. They all accept the authority of Shankaracharya. So in some ways, this will not be useful to our every occasion in any direct way. Of course, we also preach in India. And in India, as a matter of fact, there are a lot of people who accept Vedanta. When we give Bhagavad Gita lectures for Sunday feasts in the large Indian audience, all you have to do is show what Krishna really said in the Bhagavad Gita, and everybody's pretty happy, because everyone pretty much accepts the authority of the Bhagavad Gita. And as a matter of fact, we can go a little further, I think, than Elliot Deutsch. Bhagavad Gita is a very highly respected book, even if people don't accept it as divine revelation. And if you can show, you know, what Bhagavad Gita says, and it doesn't preach Mayavad philosophy, you know, Krishna says, Brahmano hi pratishtaham, I am the basis of the impersonal Brahman. You know, that in itself, by the way, a verse Shankaracharya seems to pass over in silence in his commentary. Brahmano hi pratishtaham. If you can just show that Mayavad philosophy is not taught in Bhagavad Gita, avyaktam vyaktam apanam manyante mama buddhaya, that's another great one. If you think that first I was avyakta, unmanifest, and then later I became vyakta, manifest, or person, then abuddhaya. Stupid. These are Krishna's expressions. And then you say, I'm not in any position to call anyone stupid, but what can I do? Krishna said. You know, Krishna said that. So sometimes it helps, at least with the Bhagavad Gita. Vedanta Sutra is a little more obscure for people. But it's a fact that for many, many people, this you have to, just based on philosophy or what he calls adequacy to experience. That's the appeal. So we don't have traditional grounding, so we have to understand that. So this particular concrete way of dealing with things in a debate like this or a discussion like this with other Vedantists is something we have to know how to do. Because after all, we We do preach in India, and it is the traditional grounding, and we do believe that there is a Siddhanta, there is a single conclusion of the Vedas, that that's expressed in Vedanta Sutra. It's important to us, and I think Elliot Deutsch, he sees the day is gone when anybody believes in Scripture, but it's going to come back again. But it's a fact that our situation is often quite different from that. So just keep that in mind also when you're when we see this. This is going to be a very well-defined ground. It's like lawyers in a courtroom. There's a book of law they all accept. Many times when we preach against Mayavada philosophy, nobody accepts that there's a courtroom, that there are any law books, that there's a judge, that the arguers exist. Everything is denied. So that's a problem we'll have to deal with. Okay, so any questions? Yes.
I was just wondering that you were speaking before about personalities who were speaking of one thing and weren't completely convinced of it or weren't practicing that. So what is their position? Why were they speaking like that?
I'm sorry, what are you talking about?
Oh,
because they were brought up that way, because that's their allegiance, because they want to be able to still go to church and bow down and pray and still get those good feelings, but they don't want to really have to believe these myths. They want to believe that they're committed to the moral code, but they don't really, you know, because they've studied science, they don't believe that God created the earth in 7 days. And so on. So there are various reasons they want to have allegiance. We'll look at Tillich a little more. You can see in his writings, we'll see some actual hostility toward God as the impetus toward Mayavada philosophy. But they have various reasons like that. But they do this all the time. They're symbols. We don't really have to believe them. We don't have to take them literally. But still, there's something there. Oh, I know the book I was thinking about. Paul Van Buren's The Secular Meaning of the Gospels is called. That's right, The Secular Meaning of the Gospels. One of the Death of God theologians. I studied under him. Yeah?
This is kind of an inflamed issue, but in the beginning of your class you said that Chandrasekhar Talamisha with pure devotees, although they were in the Kanishka.
Let's don't discuss that now. We only have a few more minutes. Anything particularly? We don't have any more time? Time is gone. Let me point... I'd like you to read the next section. Where's my little thing here? From where we left off, 106 to about 137. This is heavy going, a lot of this. But... And the parts that don't actually deal directly with the issues of Parinamavada and Vivartavada and Vedanta, you can skim over if you feel you don't have the time. So up to text 106 to 137. Please try to get through it because tomorrow I want to hand out some a rather long Shankaracharya purport that I'd like people to try to sink their teeth into a little bit. It's a particular purport that's mentioned by Prabhupada in the purport to text 126 as the place where Shankaracharya really does his tricks, and it's a very, very interesting one. So I Xeroxed it so we can look at that directly. So that's going to be a little hard going for reading purposes. So try to get this out of the way tonight, if you can, okay? All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Mansikar Patrigishta, Pikusin, Jabatita, Nambavani, Vivi, Vivi, Namo, Namaha.
You said 126, there's no purport.
Did I say 121? I'm sorry.
121.
There's no way you could misconstrue Brahmano Yukatishta. To mean the opposite, isn't it?
I don't think so. I think he does a job with Vyakta Vyakta Mapanam Manyat. I think he manages to turn that around somehow or other.
The
Brahmano hi pratishtham, as I remember, there's a basis, support, foundation. Yeah.
It's not much.